Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Oh, it's never good when a conference call starts like this.
Vikram chose to submit his resignation, and the board accepted it.
Big changes at Citigroup today. Also, who exactly decides who those undecided voters are that are going to be in the presidential debate tonight? We know, and we'll tell you if you stick around. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 16th of October. Good to have you with us. And hey, here's something you don't see every day. The CEO of a major American company reporting BAFO quarterly profits. And then he's gone the next day. The CEO in question is Vikram Pandit. The company is Citigroup. And the news is, if not stunning, then at least a little bit surprising. Pandit and Citi made it through the worst of the financial crisis, thanks in part to $45 billion in taxpayer bailouts. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon takes it from there.
Citigroup's stock is down almost 90% since Pandit took the helm, although many market watchers say that's just a reflection of the nightmare he inherited at the height of the financial meltdown. Lately, the bank's fortunes have shown signs of improvement. Still, banking analyst and portfolio manager Matt McCormick sees today's abrupt change in leadership as more bungling at Citigroup, and he says it explains why he's likely to keep steering clear of the stock.
They have failed to meet expectations for so long. Why would somebody go to Citigroup? Why would somebody invest in their stock when some of their peers are excelling at areas where they should be and they missed it?
Just yesterday, for example, the bank's third quarter earnings showed Citi has failed to capitalize on the recent rebound in mortgage lending. Even so, Morningstar analyst Jim Sinegal isn't expecting any major change in direction. He thinks Pandit's recent moves were starting to pay off.
You know, Citi was a financial supermarket offering everything to everyone a few years ago. That got them into a lot of trouble. Pandit really scaled back the business to focus on global businesses and urban consumers around the world.
Sinegal points out Citigroup isn't the only bank that's been dealing with turbulence, with some of its rivals suffering through unexpected losses and legal challenges.
I think it's definitely a fair question to ask whether anyone is talented enough to keep an eye on all of the operations at these large, complex institutions, and it's definitely something people should be thinking about as investors.
He says it could be that too big to fail might also mean too lumbering to succeed. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Tonight is the second presidential debate. Undecided voters in the audience will get to ask questions of the president and Governor Romney, as will the moderator, Candy Crowley, from CNN. Her, we know. Those undecided voters, not so much.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said...
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup, and he is going to be at Hofstra University tonight for the debate. Frank, it's good to talk to you again.
My pleasure.
Okay, so first of all, I learned that you helped decide what third candidates get to be in debates, and now actually you help pick the undecided voters who ask questions in town hall debates. What? How do I get that gig?
Well, we're happy to help out. We randomly select voters from around the area, wherever the debate happens to be held, and if they aren't committed, we invite them to the debate.
Okay, so I have to know what your definition of undecided is, or uncommitted, I guess.
Basically, it's true undecideds, Kai. That is, people who say no matter how much we push them, they don't have a choice. And also people who may lean to one candidate or the other, but tell us that there is still a chance that they might vote for the other person. So we put all that together, and that's our definition of uncommitted voters. And those are the ones that will be up on stage at Hofstra University.
And do you know who Candy's going to pick out of the crowd?
We do not. It's kind of like a jury, very interesting. Once they arrive at the debate venue, they then go in with Candy Crowley and her producers, and we're through. You know, it's up to them for that point. And they're kind of sequestered, so we have no idea who's going to be picked.
What's your sense then of, based on having done this for 20-something years, what kinds of questions are we likely to hear tonight?
Well, I think there'll be a mix, and I think they're great. You know, a lot of people are very worried and say, oh, these people are going to ask bizarre questions. You know, my sister was abducted by a UFO, Mr. President, what are you going to do about it, or things like that. Yeah. But they actually don't. So I think we'll get a mix. I think there'll be domestic questions and foreign policy questions, and maybe a few things that come out of the blue, which I personally think might be great. I want to see how Romney and Obama respond when it's an offbeat question. That might be fun to watch.
How have these undecided voters changed over time? I mean, is it the same kind of person?
Well, I don't think basically they've changed a lot. They tend to be more white than average because people of color, minorities tend to be strongly fixed in mm-hmm. one direction. Young people tend to be more fixed in a particular direction. So they tend to be a little more middle-aged and older. But basically, I think it's the same type of person now that we found back in 1992 when we first did this at the University of Richmond.
Do you believe that people are genuinely uncommitted at this point in a presidential campaign?
Yeah, I think that the people we identified as uncommitted genuinely could shift one way or the other. There is a group of people out there, and it could be as many in our data as one out of five, who are maybe leaning one way or the other, but it's loose enough so that something could dislodge them, so to speak, and move them in the other direction.
Yeah. Frank Newport, he's the editor-in-chief at Gallup. He's here with us every week. Frank, thanks a lot.
Glad to be with you.
If you want a little live tweeting with your debating tonight, we got it going on. You can follow me on Twitter at Kai Rizdahl. I'll be live tweeting. We're live blogging and live streaming the debate as well at marketplace.org. On Wall Street today, all three major indices built on yesterday's gains. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. These are, as we know, tenuous economic times in Spain. The government in Madrid is just about as close as you can get to asking for a bailout from the European Union without actually saying the words bailout. That would seem to make it not such a great moment for a big chunk of Spain to threaten independence, but that is what we're talking about here. The region of Catalonia is headed for snap elections next month, and the regional government in Barcelona is promising a vote on separation. Christopher Worth has more now on the economics of Catalan independence.
The bad blood between Catalonia and the rest of Spain goes back centuries. The Catalans lost their sovereignty in the early 1700s. In the 20th century, they suffered under Spanish dictator Francisco Franco. These days, the old rivalry plays out symbolically on the soccer field. At a bar near Barcelona's main stadium, fans look up at a TV and cheer as they watch Catalonia's FC Barcelona take on Madrid. Outside, Maria Lomascolo sells Catalan flags. She says for many Catalans, FC Barcelona is more than just a team. It represents Catalonia's aspirations for independence.
Playing against Madrid is like playing against the government of Madrid. So it's very heavy. Here, it's very important for Catalan people.
What's reignited these separatist feelings? In a word, money. Catalonia is one of the country's most prosperous regions. Every year, it sends about $20 billion in taxes, roughly 8% of its GDP, to Spain's central government in Madrid. From there, the money's redistributed to poorer parts of Spain, like the south. Jaume Ventura of the Center for Research in International Economics in Barcelona says many Catalans feel cheated.
For every dollar that the Catalan spends on taxes, 43 cents do not come back. Now, that's quite a bit of money.
Money Catalonia wants to keep so it can solve its own problems. The Catalan government is over $50 billion in debt. It's struggling with the same budget shortfalls as the rest of Spain. And this year, it took a $6.5 billion bailout from Madrid. But Spain's central government doesn't want one of the country's wealthiest regions just setting off on its own. It says a referendum for independence is unconstitutional. Members of the Spanish military have even threatened to intervene. Javier Diaz Jimenez is with the IESE Business School in Madrid.
There's going to be a bad divorce, so there's going to be bad feelings generated on both sides. And clearly, the economic costs of this whole thing are large.
For starters, Spaniards could retaliate by boycotting Catalan companies and goods, a blow to Catalonia's economy. Second, no one really knows whether an independent Catalonia would still be a part of the European Union that uses the euro. And Diaz Jimenez says, nationhood doesn't come cheap.
So you need to hire a bunch of border police, You need an army, you know, embassies all over the world. Man, we're talking a lot of money.
But that price tag doesn't dissuade separatists like Jordi Manya of the National Assembly of Catalonia.
A new nation, a new country, is expensive, but it's a lower cost than the one we paid to continuing being Spanish.
In a breakup, he says, Catalonia would pay its fair share of Spain's mounting public debts, but he says it also deserves to keep many of the government buildings and other assets it's already paid for. In fact, Manya thinks Spain relies too much on Catalans. He says Spaniards will ultimately be better off without them.
I think that without our money, they probably have to be more conscious that they have to work to get money.
Of course, Catalan independence is about more than just money. The region has a distinct language and culture. That's proudly on display back at the bar, where soccer fans are draped in Catalan flags. But supporters of independence face a long, hard battle with the rest of Spain. A soccer game may not tell you much about politics, but in the match between Barcelona and Madrid, neither side was a winner. In Barcelona, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Kind of sad when you have to chuck a good pair of jeans, isn't it? All broken in, stretched out in just the right places, but too beat up to be presentable, so into the trash they go. Now, a favorite pair of jeans made from trash? That's a whole nother thing. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports now on some plans that Levi has to turn recycled bottles into denim.
How many bottles does it take to make a pair of jeans?
We're using 8, to be exact.
James Curley is the president of the Levi's brand. Now, 8 bottles on their own would make an obscenely small pair of jeans. Maybe more like Daisy Dukes, or obscene Daisy Dukes. But not to fret, the plastic makes up only about 20% of a pair. The rest is cotton. Cotton with a greeny-browny tint, if you're into that.
You can see really interesting colors coming out that otherwise wouldn't come out in blue jeans.
The bottles will also boost Levi's own green tinge.
This is not new news, but what it is new news in this industry.
Marshall Cohen is a retail analyst at the NPD Group.
It gets you and I talking about it, gets the consumer talking about it, and more importantly, it gets the brand to have a positive view by the consumer.
The only potential downside Cohen sees in bottled jeans?
If they weren't able to really soften it up enough to be able to sit there and have it not scratch an itch.
But Levi's President Curley assures me that's not a problem. And he says the new denim can be worn and washed, or not washed, just like any other pair of jeans. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up, there you are, minding your own business at the grocery store.
When all of a sudden, huge volumes of new speculative money pours into the market, you get an asymmetrical market.
Wall Street and food, trust me. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial shot up 127 points today. That's almost a full percent, 13,551 the number. The NASDAQ added 36 points, 1.2%, settled at 3101. The S&P 500 put on 14 points, 1%. Ended things at 1454. Citigroup charged up 1.6% today after Vikram Pandit announced he is stepping down as CEO. J.P. Morgan Chase pocketed 1%. Johnson & Johnson bubbled up 1.3% today after reporting a slight increase in profits over last year. Apple grew 2.3% today. It sent out invitations for a, quote, special event on October 23rd. Can you say mini iPad, anybody? Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.72%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for September. It's billed as the greatest free show on earth. The Circleville Pumpkin Show gets underway in Ohio. Pies, parades, and giant pumpkins, of course. And rapper Eminem turns the big 4-0. No word on whether Slim Shady also turns 40. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. From APM, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's tricky to guess what questions those undecided voters might ask tonight, but it's probably even money that somebody's going to ask about China. Governor Romney's been hitting it pretty hard in ads and out on the campaign trail. And we've all heard how Beijing is the number one holder of U.S. debt, treasury bills. But that last fact is about to change. Bloomberg is reporting that Japan is set to become the world's number one holder of U.S. treasuries. Our Shanghai correspondent Rob Schmitz has more now on China and the American presidential campaign.
In the first presidential debate, Mitt Romney said he'd evaluate whether to fund government programs this way.
Is the program so critical it's worth borrowing money from China to pay for it? And if not, I'll get rid of it.
The notion that China is an ATM the U.S. withdraws money from when it needs it bothers a lot of economists here in China.
The argument that the U.S. is borrowing from China to fund the fiscal deficit is nonsense.
Peking University economist Michael Pettis says he wishes more people understood economics. If they did, they'd know that the U.S. doesn't borrow from China. China exports capital to the U.S., and when it does that, it buys U.S. Treasury securities. Doing so doesn't give China leverage over the U.S. as much as it ties China to the overall success of the U.S. economy. So, says Pettis, it's irrelevant which country owns the most U.S. debt.
If foreign central banks are actively purchasing U.S. treasuries as a way of generating domestic growth, then that means that the U.S. is exporting demand and its unemployment is higher than it otherwise should be.
All the China bashing is getting on the nerves of author and consultant James McGregor, too. He says it's interesting China is becoming more of a central issue in the campaign.
Their rhetoric is kind of silly and nonsensical at times, but the issue is being highlighted in a way it hasn't been before. And the reason for that is it's a very serious issue.
A serious issue, says McGregor, that's oversimplified by misleading campaign rhetoric on both sides. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
There's good news today for the 62 million Americans out there collecting Social Security. Starting next year, your monthly checks will be, on average, $21 bigger. The Social Security Administration announced its annual cost of living adjustment today. But the thing is, retirees spend money differently than the rest of us do. From the Marketplace Wealth and Poverty Desk, Shireen Marisol Meraji explains.
Dana Meyer and her husband rely on Social Security for a big chunk of their living expenses. So for Meyer, a 1.7% cost of living adjustment for 2013.
It's kind of a relief. You kind of breathe a sigh of thank goodness.
Meyer factored in the Social Security Cost of Living Adjustment, or COLA, before she retired in 2009.
And we had counted on a 2% increase in Social Security COLA, and based on that, we were pretty sure that it would be safe to retire.
But the financial crisis pushed the COLA down to zero for 2010 and 2011. Dana Meyer says something is better than nothing, but that extra cash is going to prescription drugs.
We keep a monthly spreadsheet of the medications that we purchase, and we have seen those go up quite a bit.
A typical senior spends nearly one-fifth of their entire income on health care.
David Sertner is with the AARP. He says the Consumer Price Index, which helps the Social Security Administration set the COLA, is based on the price of goods working consumers purchase. It doesn't take into account retirees' health care purchases. Danielle Holland is an executive with the Insured Retirement Institute, and she agrees with Dana Meyer.
Again, wonderful, great news that there is this increase.
But she adds that retirees are waiting to see if their Medicare Part B premiums are going up next year. If they do, as projected, that could eat up almost half of the average COLA increase. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
Back in 2003, for the bicentennial of the Louisiana Purchase, the state of Louisiana had $5.5 million to play with for ceremonies and festivities marking the moment. This year, to mark Louisiana's bicentennial as a state, officials have exactly zero public dollars with which to work, thanks to a recession and a state budget crisis that just isn't going to quit, which meant if they wanted to do the bicentennial upright, Louisiana had to get a little creative. From Baton Rouge, Keith O'Brien has the story.
The gift shop inside the old state capitol building in Baton Rouge sells bicentennial T-shirts, CDs, and tote bags. But Julie Vizano's phone has been ringing with questions about one specific souvenir.
The guns. I'm really amazed by that.
Vizano is the director of the Louisiana Bicentennial Commission, and she had a problem. The commission needed money to pay for bicentennial parades, ceremonies, and even Louisiana history classes for schools. That's when someone suggested they sell commemorative guns. So state officials decided to offer a special edition Ruger rifle and Browning shotgun. Gun sales alone won't cover the commission's $1.2 million budget, but the guns could generate $40,000 in profits.
People love to hunt. We have duck, we have deer, we have everything in between, fishing. So it's a natural fit for Louisiana guns to go together, I suppose.
Think about it for a second. Louisiana is the sportsman's paradise.
Randy Haney is the chief fundraiser for the Bicentennial Commission and the proud owner of one of the bicentennial shotguns. It sells for $1,812, a nod to the year, 1812, that Louisiana became a state. And for Haney, the shotgun will be a showpiece.
I'll keep it in my gun case and probably not shoot it because it's a commemorative and it holds its value longer.
But the Ruger? That's a working gun, Haney says. A rifle popular for hunting squirrels and alligators, which a lot of people enjoy.
Bowie Outfitters, this is Jordan. Can I help you?
At Bowie Outfitters in Baton Rouge, General Manager David Renerson can't keep the commemorative guns in stock.
We ran out, and our mistake, we didn't order more. But I put this gun on the counter, and it'll sell probably today. It's a really nice gun.
The $1,812 shotgun is easy to assemble, Renerson says. But if you could only own one gun, it would be the less expensive Ruger.
Let's load her up. Load her up and see if it works. I got a feeling it'll fire pretty good.
It's a versatile rifle, Renerson says, a fact that he demonstrates in a secure test range at Bowie Outfitters.
Ready?
The Ruger sells for $289, 10% of which goes to the Bicentennial Commission. That's great for parades. Maybe not so good for the squirrels. In Baton Rouge, I'm Keith O'Brien for Marketplace.
Natural disasters, from drought to flood and almost everything in between, can do quite a number on farmers and their crops and the prices that consumers wind up paying. Look no farther than the Midwest this past summer. But nature's not the only reason that food prices go up. In his new book, Bet the Farm, How Food Stopped Being Food, Frederick Kaufman says Wall Street has a little something to do with it, too. Fred Kaufman, good to have you with us.
Hey, thanks.
You start this book in a Domino's pizza factory, and I guess you went to Michigan, right?
Yeah, I did.
And, you tell the whole story about mixing a quarter-ton batch of dough and all this stuff. But then at one point, you talk about this guy at Domino's complaining about how he got blown out in his tomato hedges.
Yeah.
Explain that, because that's kind of an extraordinary thing.
So I'm at Domino's right after one of the three great price spikes in food in the last 5 years. And what happens is that people need to manage their risks in terms of the cost of food going forward. And so what they basically do is they place bets on imaginary food. In other words, promises to buy and sell food that does not yet exist at some time in the future. That's a futures market, okay? And if you let's say you promise to sell tomatoes at a certain price and the tomato price just skyrockets, you really lose a lot of money.
Why are banks bad for food? I mean, that's kind of the thesis here, right?
Banks are food neutral. The problem is speculating in food. And you've seen that a lot of banks, not just Goldman, but Deutsche and Barclays in particular and J.P. Morgan Chase, began to realize this was an area of profit. And they just went into it with full force. And they transformed a market that had worked very well because they are not particularly interested in the beauty of well-working markets. They're interested in profit. They're interested in making money.
Let me give you the Wall Street counterpoint, right, which will be we supply liquidity to the markets. We ensure efficient movement of capital to where it needs to go to assure maximum productivity and the cheapest possible product, and we're doing a good thing.
That's absolutely true, but not today. These food commodity markets worked beautifully for about 100 years, right? And there was a really nice balance of speculators and bona fide hedgers. And Commodity markets need speculation. Speculation in and of itself is not bad. The real price of wheat actually went down throughout the 20th century, remained stable. And of course, that's no coincidence. That's the greatest century of American strength. But when all of a sudden huge volumes of new speculative money pours into the market, you get an asymmetrical market. Volatility starts going crazy. The market needs to be re-regulated.
Well, I get what you're saying, but if the markets had worked so well for 100 years, how come you still had people starving? How come everybody didn't have cheap, healthy, delicious food, as you say in this book?
You know, it's funny. The hunger numbers are very hard to parse. I think that, you know, there is a very strong sense right before the Green Revolution, we had to do something about global hunger, right? We brought the numbers down, then they went back up again. This is really unconscionable. A billion hungry people, that's kind of an apocalyptic number. And it's certainly unconscionable in an age where we have iPods and iPhones and all sorts of technology. This is a simple technology, is putting food in people's mouths.
The book is called Bet the Farm, How Food Stopped Being Food. The author is Frederick Kaufman. Fred, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which I found courtesy of Felix Salmon's Twitter feed, Foreign Policy Magazine, it seems, has put together a list of 15 questions it would like to see asked at a presidential debate. Here's one of them. What's your stance on the Scottish independence referendum? Here's another one. Nagorno-Karabakh, thoughts? Here's one they could have stolen from this show today. Japan, as you know, is about to replace China as America's biggest creditor. Could you please offer us some meaningless bluster about, quote, getting tough with Tokyo? They're all pretty good. You can read them at our website. It's marketplace.org. And with that, we're out of here. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow Industrials up 127 points, almost a full percent, 13,551. The NASDAQ added 36 points, 1.2%, 3101. The S&P 500, while it put on 14 points, 1%, ended things at 1454. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Mary Dew, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rada Bead. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.